I think everybody knows that we're living in a very divisive time, and that's why we're talking with Dr. Martin Karkasid. He is a professor in communication studies at Colorado State University. He is also the founder of the Center of Public Deliberation. We're sitting here at Dazbog Coffee. If you hear a little bit of ambient sound, that's what you're hearing. But I can guarantee there's a lot of collaboration and problem solving going on between friends. Why is it so hard, though, when we're talking about divisive subjects?
Our brains are wired in so many ways for tribalism and for kind of picking our sides and those type of things. So when the conversations start there, they're going to go to a bad place. So a lot of what we do with the center is change that conversation, frame issues differently, get people in small groups, have them to react to information that's framed to spark a conversation. And we've actually had a lot of success. So there's a lot of ways of getting people to talk about issues differently.
Well, the dominant way seems to be talk louder and throw more facts at each other. Why is this so ineffective?
Yeah, facts in particular are really ineffective in a polarized environment. We're really good at getting new facts to fit into our existing narrative rather than allowing new facts to challenge that narrative. Basically, the way that we work with facts is if the facts fit our narrative, we love them and we share them. If they don't fit our narrative, we can pretty easily dismiss them. So we can't rely on facts to change the conversation. We have to change the environment for the conversation, and then all of a sudden facts might matter again. So when we talk about the processes we design, the conversations we try to spark, we're doing two things. One is we're trying to avoid triggering the worst parts of our brain. If we're successful at doing that, then we can actually tap into the best part of our brains. The exciting stuff when you look at the social psychology and brain science is a lot of bad news, but the good news is probably the defining feature of our species is that we're collaborative problem solvers. It's just our political conversations rarely tap into that. When we find ways of doing that, we can have a lot of success in getting people to work together. The way it seems so difficult or it seems so polarized is that often our loudest voices are the most polarized. They're the ones that are going to be the most active on social media. They're the ones sitting letters to the editor, they're the ones talking the most, right? So part of the arguments that we make is we're not as divided as we think. That's part of it. The people that do the kind of work that I do across the country will report, if you get people in the room and you have a good process and you got framing, that polarization and the cynicism isn't that thick. You can change it. And you have these wonderful aha moments when people realize that the person across the table is not evil. You can actually have a conversation with them. These conversations are happening all the time. There's plenty of examples, particularly the local area, of people working across perspectives to deal on tough issues. The problem is the most dominant narrative is this national narrative that we hear 24/7 on 10 different channels that's feeding us this polarization.
Human beings are natural storytellers. It's just the way our brain works. How is it that this natural storytelling ability ends up producing narratives that can be counterproductive?
I completely agree that we are much more narrative beings than logical or rational beings. Stories are very powerful. Stories can be very powerful in a good way and a bad way. The problem is the most basic story that's ingrained in us across all cultures, across all times, is a simple good versus evil narrative with the hero and the villain. Two-party system completely fits that narrative from the very beginning. You have a set villain, you have set heroes, and then all the information, all the facts are kind of filtered through that lens. On the good side, though, is when you get people together and you let them actually hear each other's story, it's really hard to hate up close, right? So the power of the small group conversation, the power of a real person talking to another real person, can actually bring out that other narrative. When we hear each other's story, it gets more complicated. I mean, we can kind of get away from that simple narrative.
Even the nicest and smartest people can fall prey to things like confirmation bias and selective exposure. Talk to us a little bit about what those do and how they interfere with our ability to communicate and get to the truth.
This is part of what I was talking about how our brains are very good at getting existing information to fit within our narrative or fit within our perspective and challenge it. Selective exposure is you tend to seek out information from people that already agree with you, or you're watching the news channels that already agree with you. So you're primarily getting biased information before it even hits you. You're just exposing yourself to one side. And confirmation bias is the process of how do you actually take that information in? How are you making sense of it? When we hear what we want to hear, we eat it up. And when we hear something we don't want to hear, we can either avoid it, or even worse, we take it on and overcome it. That's really the scariest part of some of this research. Backfire effect fits in here as well. If I'm trying to convince you you're wrong, the stronger my argument, the more it might actually backfire, because your brain is able to find some sort of flaw in my argument. And by finding one minor flaw, you can dismiss the whole thing. And at the end of the exchange, you're thinking, you know, he brought his best stuff and I knocked it out of the park. So you're even more convinced that you're right. That really kind of points us to not giving up on facts, but realizing you can't just build up an argument of facts and throw it to the other side. That's either not going to work or it might actually backfire. So again, how do we change the conversation? How do we change the environment of the conversation that facts can actually do what we need them to do?
Let's talk a little bit about something specific. Let's talk about water scarcity. diversity here in Colorado. It's a big issue, and it's going to become a bigger issue as population grows and as the state gets less water. How do we take the principles that you've identified about bringing people into a small group, having referees? How would you bring people around the table to talk about how we handle water scarcity?
That's an issue we've been working on for several years. Mayor Lee Smith at the CSU Water Institute has had a group going that's been trying to do exactly that. And when we started, I still use that as an example when I talk about the concept of wicked problems, which I think is a very useful concept to really get your head around and to spark these better conversations. It's a complex kind of term, but the easiest way to kind of think about it is a wicked problem inherently has competing underlying values that are important to people. What we try to do with wicked problems is we're trying to shift the dominant narrative from an assumption of wicked people, the simple good versus evil story we love, to putting the wickedness in the problem. So if you look at water, we want our water to do lots of different things for us, lots of good things, but those things don't fit together. So when you frame it to say, okay, we want water in the river, and we want water for our lawns, and we want water for open space, and we want economic vitality, we want all these different kind of things, what we want to do is to spark a conversation about how do we negotiate these tensions? How do we find the best way as a community to work across all these? But that's not what typically happens. Most of our conversations, the way our brains work, is we pick one value and we frame it as I care about that value, and anyone disagrees with rejecting that value. That's that simple story that we talk past each other, and it creates a lot more polarization and frustration. If you frame something as a wicked problem and you kind of get people together under that, you have these transformations, you're switching from wicked people to wicked problems, you're shifting from an adversarial mode to a collaborative mode. That's exactly what we were talking about, of lighting up the good parts of your brain versus the bad parts of your brain, because when you're in adversarial mode, you're just not thinking very well. And then when you do that, that's when the facts kind of change. In adversarial mode, facts are not going to do their work. In collaborative mode, we want good information to make better decisions, right? So now all of a sudden together we're kind of seeking out those facts that we need.
Let me take it up a notch. What about climate change? There is obviously competing values there. You've got developing countries burning a lot of coal. You've got people not wanting to make any kind of lifestyle change. And you have people who are still very skeptical of the information. How would you recommend hitting that issue, which is particularly divisive?
Climate change is a super wicked problem. It's one of the first ones that really have driven a lot of the truth decay and the post-fact society in some sense, that you've seen it historically. And it's a good example of the polarization at the top. All of a sudden, as an issue gets defined on one side of the aisle or the other, it really kind of undermines a lot of the conversations. My work particularly focuses on the local level, so there's a lot of people doing deliberation on a much kind of broader international issue. One way I'm talking about it these days is I think that the biggest question we're going to have for the next 10 years is, does the dysfunction and the polarization at the national level continue to bleed down? Or does some of the actual good stories and the collaboration that's happening at the local level kind of move up? Certainly my goal is that latter. How do we get more and more cities and communities to show people we can take on these issues? To go back to climate change, you are seeing individual cities, Fort Collins being one of them. It's taking climate seriously, bringing people together across perspectives to think about how can we be an example and how can we move this forward. If we're going to make progress on climate change, it's probably going to be more individual cities showing people how it's done versus starting at the UN or starting at the national level coming down.
I want to ask you about science communication. I think there's a sense that if the experts are talking, people will listen. What's the flaw in that idea?
One of the biggest underlying tensions in democracy in general is this tension between democracy and expertise. On the democracy side, it's about inclusion and voices and majority. And on the expertise side, it's like, well, no, it's about rigor and data and science and quality and hierarchy in a way. And certainly universities are negotiating that tension all the time. There's always a danger, you know, with any tension, we're trying to find the kind of the perfect balance between that. And that's always going to be an ongoing conversation. I think there's been times that the balance has been too far to the expert side, that we've deferred too much to expert, and we've kind of given up the public power. And then sometimes I think we're too far on the other side, that we've dismissed expertise. So I think that's part of the national conversation we need to be having. That's exciting. The Museum of Nature and Science is contributing to that in some ways. Like, how do we have some real conversations about what is the role of expertise? What is the role of science? And it's not something that we want to give it too much power, but we also don't want to go too far to the other side.
I can see where sometimes when scientists or experts talk, that they may not be identifying some of these underlying values. and may accidentally alienate some people from hearing that expertise.
One of the reasons I think the Wicked Problems framework is a very useful thing. When I started doing this work 12 years ago, I used to always talk about three different ways of kind of talking or politics. There's the expert kind of politics, there's adversarial politics, our dominant Democrat versus Republican system, and then deliberative politics, which is what I do. Part of the argument is when you think about things as Wicked Problems, the biggest issues we're dealing with, the heart of the issue, these competing underlying values that don't fit together very well, that's the conversation we need to have. But adversarial politics really doesn't do those well, right? Because we naturally want to frame things in simple ways, and most of the loudest voices are always going to frame things in good versus evil, so it makes it a lot harder. But the same thing, experts really struggle with that Wicked Problem. Experts don't do values well, right? It's hard to quantify values, it's hard to kind of come up with a clear definition. Clearly, people rank values differently and apply them differently. So experts are very useful to help us to understand cause and effect, and understand kind of what's working and what's not working, but experts can't make those decisions for us. There's no expert in how do we rank our values. So that's where we have to kind of negotiate this constant tension between democracy and expertise, because the people are the ones that do the value work. The expertise give us the kind of solid information to make better decisions. We have to figure out ways of melding that together.
When you bring in a team of facilitators to break down a Wicked Problem and come up with a solution, what does that look like?
I'll push back on the solution, right? Because one of the other aspects of Wicked Problems is you don't solve them. Wicked Problems are always going to be with us. The toughest problems we have, we're not going to figure out the solution, apply it, and it's gone. So whether we're negotiating democracy and expertise, or we're, you know, a lot of the work I do is pulling the values from the preamble of the Constitution, that we want equality and we want liberty and we want freedom and we want security. We can never figure out the exact way to order those. It's always going to be an ongoing conversation. What we do at the CBD is actually train undergraduate students that are taking a special course at facilitation. So we have a group of 30 or 40 students that we can show up at an event, and instead of 100 people showing up and either sitting down listening to a panel of experts or walking up to that microphone one at a time and kind of talking past each other, we can put them at 15 different tables with a design kind of process and actually talk through it. So a lot of the work that we do before for a Wicked Problem is we try to make sense of the noise. We're looking at the letters to the editor. The Fort Collins City Council might send me all the emails they received on an issue. Colorado might write an article and have, you know, wonderful comments on the articles that we tend to get these days. That's still useful information for me to see how are people talking about it. What values are they invoking? What arguments are they making? Then we kind of go through all that, and then we try to put that in a more useful way, right? So we create these backgrounders or discussion guides that kind of frame the issue from the different sides, then people can react to. Trying to tap into that collaborative brain, we're asking people at the small groups to react to these materials and to improve them. We know we didn't get them right. Hopefully we frame them more productively. Then it becomes this group process. Okay, how do we react to this? How do we clarify the advantages and disadvantages of different perspectives? What's missing in here? And what do they want to push back on? And that directs their attention in a different way, in a much more productive way than just showing up and expressing your individual opinion, right? Too much of our public engagement is basically just allowing people to express their individual opinion. But we know, because of selective exposure and confirmation bias, most people's individual opinions are pretty biased. The public input process is just one at a time in a microphone to express your individual opinion. It's not a very useful thing.
So it sounds like you facilitate greater understanding, which then leads to greater clarity around costs and benefits. And once you've gotten to costs and benefits, you're no longer talking about good and evil, my side, your side. We're talking about how we can meet maybe in the middle and address both the costs and the benefits.
Certainly getting away from the simple good versus evil kind of either or. We're also trying to get away from kind of the simple both and. The first place people go is like, you know, we need both. And we push them on that as well, because it's not a simple just balance, right? It's okay, how much of each? What does that balance look like? It's this notion of negotiating tensions, but where on that spectrum do we need to be? Where are we now? You know, so sometimes it's about balance. Sometimes it's about having to make some tough choices and prioritize. Hopefully it's about transcending attention. It's finding a win-win. If you go back to traditionally the economy and the environment were kind of at odds with each other, but then something like green jobs transcends that. We're creating wealth, we're creating jobs in a way that's good for the planet. Fort Collins in particular considers itself a triple bottom line city. So yeah, the economy matters. Yes, we want businesses to make a profit, but we also care about kind of social things and we care about the environment. But we're not seeing those as in competition with each other. We do see that there's inherent tensions between them. They don't always fit together very well. But when you make that the issue, the Wicked Problem is how do you kind of manage these three things at the same time? You're actually sparking creativity and you're sparking collaboration to manage it better, versus framing as you're for the economy or you're against it, or you're for the environment or you're against it.
What is the difference between deliberation and dialogue?
Dialogue is interactive communication primarily focused on developing trust and understanding, just to hear each other's story. So it's non-judgmental, right? You're supposed to just listen to each other. Deliberation is interactive communication about making decisions together. It's about weighing things, weighing choices. So a big distinction is deliberation can't be non-judgmental. We have to make decisions. We have to set priorities. We have to make some tough choices. We have to engage those tensions.
Would you say it's a kind of a step two? I mean, because you can't really have deliberation if you don't first have dialogue.
So I have a Venn diagram that has deliberation in the middle, and then debate on one side overlapping deliberation, and then dialogue on the other overlapping deliberation. But debate and dialogue don't overlap. And I talk about them as these three interactive communication modes. So debate is about clash. It's about arguments. And most of our debate, unfortunately, is really bad. Most of our debate is just spectacle. It's just, you know, who got the best zinger. But good debate is still important and still useful. We just don't see it very often. Debate works. What happens with debate is strong arguments get elevated and weak arguments get exposed. So that's the value of a debate if it works well. There is kind of an information and a rigor to it. The problem is, going back to the human nature stuff, good arguments don't win automatically. And often in the marketplace of ideas, really bad arguments win because the person's good at selling them. They have a louder voice or whatever, right? So you look at debate, you know, so we need that function of good debate, elevating good arguments and exposing weak arguments. On the other side, dialogue is about creating relationships and creating understanding. Deliberation, for me, brings those two together. We need the relationships, we need the trust, we need to understand each other, because if we don't have that, then the debate doesn't work. But once I respect you, then I'm going to take your opinion seriously, and I'm going to take your information seriously. So debate without relationship, without connection or trust, doesn't work. But the same thing, dialogue can sometimes overemphasize the relationship, overemphasize the non-judgmental. One way to think about this is, in dialogue, open-mindedness is huge, but at some point, we can be too open-minded. We can say everyone's opinion's equally valid. That's dangerous. Going back to Daniel Patrick Moynihan, everyone's got the right to their own opinion. Not everyone has the right to their own facts. Certainly, I believe everyone's opinion has some value. We want all voices to be heard. But at some point, if we're getting to the deliberation and we're making decisions together, we need to do that harder work on the back end of saying, how do we prioritize these? Which values are more important? Which ideas are stronger? Which arguments have more merit to them? And so that's where, for deliberation, we need to bring together the best of debate and the best of dialogue. Too often, we're just doing those by themselves. One of the things I talk about, the positive aspects of human nature, is that we are naturally empathetic. We do care about each other. And there's a lot of new research coming out about how do we tap into that. And there's so much concern about social media. We're seeing now research that shows starting to get reduction in empathy. And one of the reasons that experts are saying is because we often have our toughest conversations through social media, through text now. So our brain is not making those connections. If I'm telling you bad news, if I don't see your facial expression, my brain doesn't make that connection. I'm realizing now the importance of these face-to-face conversations. There's a lot of tools, a lot of websites out there to engage people across perspective online, and I hope some of those work. They don't tend to be nearly as popular as the ones that gather around like-minded people and say bad things on the other side. But one thing we're realizing with these real events and a small table with a facilitator, it's real people having a conversation, hearing each other's stories, but also seeing their reaction. Part of what we're trying to do, and part of why I'm still kind of an old school, real people talking to each other face to face, is what's so critical for us to kind of move past some of these things. And that certainly is much more likely to happen at the local level than the national level. But how do we get people talking, I think, is one of our biggest challenges.